Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Douglas Brown, who reads from and discusses his new book, Just Do It, How One Couple Turned Off the TV and Turned On Their Sex Lives for 101 Days, published by Crown. In the weeks to come, we have Chuck Klosterman, Jules Pfeiffer, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, I'd like to thank you for coming to tonight's event and for your support of independent bookstores. Tonight, we are pleased to welcome local author Douglas Brown, who will read from and discuss his new memoir, Just Do It, How One Couple Turned Off the TV and Turned On Their Sex Lives for 101 Days, No Excuses. The book describes how after 14 years together, a happy but harried couple set out to have sex for 101 consecutive nights and did it. Doug is a feature writer for the Denver Post. He was previously a reporter for the Albuquerque Tribune, the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and the Washington Post, among others. He lives in Boulder with his wife, Annie, whose idea this was, and their two daughters. Please join me in welcoming Doug Brown.
So, yes, I'm Doug Brown, and I did have sex with my wife for 101 consecutive days. Thank you for showing up. I appreciate it. Yes, that's the book. Just Do It. And let me stipulate, at the time, I was 40, and he was 38. We had two kids, two careers. We'd been together 14 years, and we had a minivan. And we still did it for 101 consecutive days. Needless to say that the minivan, two-job, two-career, middle-aged thing doesn't really describe the typical kind of sexual freak, but we did it. It was a lot of fun. You know, it really was. And it's happy as it sounds, we really learned a lot about doing it with each other for 101 consecutive days. Who knew that a prolonged and intense roll in the hay would reveal so much about each other and sort of add so much glue to our relationship? Now, you know, it's more than 2 years after we started our wild romp. There's no doubt that our relationship is stronger than it was. And, you know, I got to say, I credit the sex. You know, there's something special and very unique that comes with sex. It's a feeling that there's this feeling of being desired. And it's not the kind of desire, you know, that you feel when, you know, your law partners, you know, give you the case because you're good with mining law, or the kind of desire you feel because your mother loves you. It's a totally different kind of desire that only comes with sex. And I think that doing it, I think the more you sort of buttress that feeling, that kind of unique feeling of knowing that your partner desires you, the more you buttress that, the better off you are. And I think the more it kind of fades and withers, it's sad, and it's not good, because that is a very unique feeling that you can only get from doing it with your partner. And I'm talking in the context of relationships. I think it works in the context of one-night stands as well, but for me, I'm talking about relationships. The book, to the misplaced, and I assure you it's the misplaced dismay of some, is not pornography. It is spicy, though, and it was tough to write. It was really tough to write, because on the one hand, you know, I knew there was nothing like this out there. There was no intimate, there was no window into the intimate life of a couple. There really wasn't anything like this. There's a million books about the Kama Sutra. There's a lot of books and, you know, a lot of worthwhile, important books by therapists. But there was not this sort of window into the intimate life of, you know, quote-unquote normal couple. Yet at the same time, I didn't want to embarrass Annie, my wife, and to a lesser extent myself. I think it goes without saying my kids one day will be quite embarrassed, but we can talk about that in the question and answer session. So it was tough to write. I wanted the thing to be just to be very honest, and I think I pulled that off. As far as the embarrassing part goes, I don't know. There's certainly parts in the book that are kind of embarrassing, but I guess that kind of goes with the territory. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and read the introduction. That'll be the longest. It's like a 5-minute thing, and there's not spicy at all. And after that, I'm going to sort of bounce around, pick up little short 2-minute things here and there, and then I'll take questions. Like you, I've enjoyed my share of days I like to think of as most excellent. The days my daughters were born, for example, are hard to beat. I recall a long spell at the Jersey Shore in the early 1980s when the waves kept rolling in, glassy and lovely, and I surfed until it grew dark. There was a dawn to midnight rendezvous with my brother when we hiked in alpine splendor and topped it off with green chili cheeseburgers, beer, and hammocks. And then there was the otherwise forgettable day, the year I turned 40, on which my wife, Annie, said the 8 words that changed our life together in a most excellent way. This smashing day began in Florida, where I had just finished a week-long conference dedicated to sex, popular culture, and the media. I'm a reporter, and at the time, sex, pornography, strippers, sex addiction, you name it, was one of my principal areas of coverage. A flight, which is never something I celebrate, devoured most of the afternoon, but things improved when Annie arrived to pick me up at the Denver airport. Her signature style, which she calls messy sexy, was in full flower. Thick auburn hair pinned loosely to the back of her head, with big strands falling to her shoulders. Groovy patterned blouse exposing a hint of cleavage. Tight jeans and her favorite Israeli sandals and red lipstick. Her grin and sparkling eyes said, "Welcome home, lovey." And then I peered in the back of the minivan, and there was Joni, nearly 7, and Ginger, approaching 3, their very beings quaking with, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." That night, after we'd put the girls to bed, Annie and I, as usual, slipped into something comfortable. For Annie, threadbare pajamas emblazoned with faded roses. For me, blue sweatpants with 5 pockets that I'd been wearing for at least 15 years. This is now in parentheses, I'm going to whisper the parenthetical things. I champion pockets whenever I get a chance. I have announced to Annie no less than 486 times since we began dating, "I love pockets." 2 front pockets held cotton handkerchiefs because I didn't go anywhere without cotton handkerchiefs, thus perhaps my obsession with pockets. I believe I loosed a long, "ah," a sound familiar to people who frequent hot tubs, as I slid my sweat-panted legs beneath the covers, pressed my back into the pillow with squat arms behind me, and prepared for an hour or two of reading before drifting into slumber. Soon, Annie squeezed her cute little body between the sheets, too, and, like me, propped herself against a poofy-armed pillow. These pillows are known as husbands for reasons that defy rigorous analysis, unless one concludes that husbands are things into which wives lean. A conviction, I assure you, will be challenged by many who will say, if that's the reasoning, they should be called wives. And so we sat side by side, cocooned and snug and reading quietly in our little house in a new subdivision on the prairie in Denver. At some point, I started talking about things I remembered about the conference, most of which survived like alien dreams in a relentlessly tropical setting. One solemn detail, however, remained crystalline. "Get this," I said. "One guy from Denmark talked about how men who are involved in relationships but haven't had sex in 100 days or more actually bond over their sad predicaments. They form 100 days clubs or something like that. At least that's what I thought he said." I had some trouble with his accent. The sexless marriage is a big Oprah thing," said Annie. 2 careers, kids, middle age, bunch of years together. It can complicate the sex life." "Yes," I thought, "it can. We've been together about 14 years, married for nearly 11 of them, with kids for almost 7. We both worked. Excellent sex had decorated the first half of our relationship, but the quality and quantity of sex had declined as we approached our mid-30s. Careers and age shifted our end-of-the-day enthusiasms from carnal athletics to pulling sheets to shoulders and whispering, 'Good night.' 2 pregnancies and infancies had provided us acceptable rationales for begging off sex for longer and longer periods of time. We never abstained for 100 days, but in those sex challenge zones between the third trimester and infanthood, we'd probably gone 6 weeks without doing it. Now, more than 3 years after the birth of our second daughter, we did it about once a week, if we were lucky. Our union was not suffering. We rarely fought, and we were attracted to similar things, cooking, hiking, playing games. We could talk for hours without growing bored. Our children, the stars of our lives, drew us close. But I cannot paint over the fissures and rough patches, what the real estate people call wear and tear, that had crept into the house of Doug and Annie. Sex, for example, had turned into a mere adequacy, an activity relying on recitation and rote rather than free-form play. The panting excitement that had electrified the early days of our relationship had developed into something else, not a snore or a sigh, but maybe a hum, a sound suggesting contentment and harmony. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for contentment and harmony, but I think you'll agree with me here. Zest, sparkle, and freewheeling passion have their moments, too. Money, or the lack thereof, long ago it introduced tensions into our marriage, most notably after Annie stopped working during her third trimester with Joni. Between that exit from the working world and the genesis of Annie's 100 days idea, we moved 5 times, and Annie gave birth to 2 daughters 4 years apart. One modest salary, as a result, was stretched awfully thin between bills, saving for house down payments, and our growing family. Only a pittance was left for things like dinner dates and vacations, and it led to most of the sharpest exchanges between Annie and me. Our latest move from Baltimore to Denver also contributed to the wear and tear. I'm close to my extended family, most of which lives in southeastern Pennsylvania. When we lived in Baltimore, we routinely spent time with my parents and my brother, with a sister-in-law and nephews and cousins and uncles and aunts. Annie and I had moved so many times that I thought another move would come easy, but it was not to be. Homesickness plagued me in Denver, and never had I been so curdled with guilt. The move had physically estranged Joni and Ginger from routine contact with my family's warmth and love, an outcome that flooded me with heartache. By accepting the gig in Denver, I'd hurt my kids and I'd hurt my parents. The move upended Annie, too, removing her from a happy nest of friends in the lovely house in Baltimore that we had bought for a pittance. At the same time, though, it brought her back to the West, a region she adored, and shortly after moving to the Mile High City, Annie scored her first real job in 7 years. While I talked incessantly about returning to the East, Annie resisted. Here was another crack in our foundation. Finally, the previous 7 years or so had witnessed our turn from carefree couple without kids to something altogether different, parents. Our children, for good reason, commandeered the center of our life together. This was not something to lament, but it was something we should have examined with greater care. Things had changed, some not for the better. A little recognition and attention might have helped. In short, although the house of Doug and Annie remained sturdy, it needed a little updating, some renovation, a ration of what a certain kind of realtor might call pizzazz. "It's a big problem for a lot of people, I think," said Annie, knitting a purple hat with a green top, a cap meant to look like an eggplant. "A challenge. How do you squeeze in sex?" I returned to my magazine for a few moments, and then Annie turned toward me, grinning. "I've got an idea," she said. "Why don't we start our own club? Only we'll reverse it. Instead of not having sex for 100 days, and here come those delicious 8 words, let's have sex for 100 consecutive days." I waited a few beats, studying Annie. I could tell she was serious. "What a most excellent day," I thought. And then, "That's insane." Okay, now I'm going to cut here. The rest of these are much shorter. This little section, my mom is flying into town. We had long planned for our anniversary. We always would go away somewhere. And off my mom would fly out and watch our kids while we did this. So this year we had found a cabin down by Buena Vista, beautiful little cabin with a hot spring. It was incredible. Anyway, my mom was coming in, so I'm describing my mom flying in to watch the kids. Mom flew in from Philadelphia to watch the kids while Annie and I drove a few hours south to a 100-year-old log cabin in the mountains to celebrate our 11th wedding anniversary. I, of course, did not have to reveal our upcoming sex campaign, but I've always told my mom nearly everything. Annie and I were yakking about it to our close friends because we knew they would get a kick out of the sexpedition, and they might have good ideas for us. It didn't take long for me to announce the adventure to my parents, although in this case I wasn't gunning for any ideas. Honey, that's a classic, said my mom after she finished laughing during a phone call weeks earlier when I hit her with the news. Here, she said to Dad, handing him the phone, you've got to listen to this one. That's awesome, he said after the punchline. And so, Dad, we're going to have sex for 100 consecutive days. Totally awesome. I felt as though I just won the Heisman Trophy. Weeks later, Mom began laughing as soon as she entered our minivan at the airport. I sat beside this elderly woman, she reported as we drove back to our white picket-fenced house. She asked why I was coming to Colorado. I told her to visit my son and daughter-in-law and my precious grandchildren. But eventually, she began asking me exactly what we were doing, and for some reason, I told her. Everything? I asked. Yeah, said Mom, every last detail. You know what? She actually asked me, you know, how do they define it? The kids were in the car, so she had to speak in code, but by the lift in her eyebrows, we knew it meant sex. What did you tell her? I whispered, instantly uncomfortable with the direction of the conversation was headed. I told her I didn't know, she said. I just nodded. Now, so after that, there was this period of training where we were getting ready for this expedition. And so we went to see a doctor, and and one of the things was reading books. And so this is in the in-training period. And we were getting in shape. That was part of it, too. But anyway, it wasn't just our bodies that demanded attention, though. We needed to condition our minds as well. So we began combing the Denver Public Library for appropriate titles. We found books about ancient Egyptian sexual positions and traditional Japanese approaches to romance and sex. I read them all. We checked out dozens of books, which made for interesting excursions. With each of my library visits, every one, an almost caricatured version of Little Old Lady stood in line behind me, smelling of lilac, hair a white meringue, clutching a sensible handbag. There she'd stand a few feet away as I dragged barcodes beneath lasers and titles flashed on a screen. The Yin-Yang Butterfly, Ancient Chinese Sexual Secrets for Western Lovers. A Lover's Guide to the Kama Sutra. The Multi-Orgasmic Woman. I'm always thinking of Annie. I would stuff my stack of books into a plastic bag and slink away from the little old lady in her wool skirt. Yet despite all of the fresh focus in the carnal world, the volume of actual sex hadn't changed for us since our return from the cabin. Do you think it's a problem, said Annie one night during our training period? We're not having any more sex than usual. I slugged back a big gulp of India Pale Ale, a style of beer Annie and I drank for its almost saffron bitterness, a flavor we treasured. I don't know, I said, maybe. I'd been 40 for nearly half a year. I'd celebrated the summer day I said goodbye to those blessed 30s, repeatedly telling people, hey, it's just some random date. I guess I'm 40 now, though I still feel like I'm 25. But weeks later, undercurrents of melancholy appeared. During the sex conference in Florida, I encountered a very young and exceptionally talented New York writer whose virility could fairly be described as majestic. His octopus grasp of cool and the way women watching him ran their fingers along the edges of their cocktail glasses were intimidating. Shortly after the conference, the newspaper sent me to New York City to write a profile of the Colorado native editor of Us Weekly. The age of 40 is about average, even a bit on the young side in many big city newspapers, but it registered as nearly prehistoric in the Us Weekly offices, where there was nothing less than a parade of youth. A brassy 27 reporter with magnetic cleavage and spiky heels and a boozy job full of publicists and nightclubs. A fabulous and urbane youngster whose command of his own presence was so accomplished and daunting, he seemed destined for a life of increasingly wonderful fabulousness. And the editor-in-chief herself, a breathtakingly stylish, sexy, and smart 30-something. All this brought back the deflating hiss I'd experienced in the company of the very young New York writer. But by the end of the Manhattan trip, just weeks after Annie had dreamed up the sex marathon, the hiss was gone and, not to brag, was replaced with the welcome sound of a swelling balloon. I may be getting old, I thought, but soon I'm getting laid. A lot more than ever, more than you. So there. All right, now we jump ahead. I was a reporter at the Post. My beat was sex, and I had to go to the porno industry has an annual convention in Las Vegas, and I had to go to this thing to cover it for the newspaper. But of course, Annie had to come with me because we were in the middle of this sexathon. So we went to the porn conference in Vegas, And here, I'll just... We entered the Venetian, it's a hotel, the site of the show, and immediately I encountered a category of woman I had never seen in person. Porn stars dressed as porn stars. Of course, previously and unwittingly, I may have encountered hundreds of porn stars in real life, only instead of dressing like porn stars, they were wearing sweatsuits. Their outfits were tight and tiny, their heels towering, their breasts just gigantic. Disembodied, engorged, taut udders, missiles, a monstrous throng of them bouncing through the casino, catching the eyes of men and women everywhere in Hawaiian shirts and turquoise blouses, clutching cigars and lukewarm bottles of Miller. Heads swiveled, mouths open, and jaws actually did drop. Oh my God! And that was just on the casino floor. Then there was the show itself, where Annie wandered wearing the first press pass ever to dangle from her neck. She was there to take pictures. The Post didn't send a photographer to accompany me, and Annie's no professional photographer, but we thought a picture might come in handy, if not for the paper, then at least for the website. The laminated pass thrilled her like few things I'd ever witnessed. Our press pass gave us nimble access to the upstairs explosion of porn stars, and to the downstairs horizon of sex toy vendors and symposium speakers and porno technology geeks and their online businesses. Everywhere we walked, hardcore sex played on gigantic flat-screen televisions. And beneath the televisions, the actual women in the videos, the stars of the scenes that were playing above, signed autographs, posed for pictures with their fans, and licked their lips with great suggestive power. "Check out that rack!" shouted a guy wearing sweatpants and a Raiders sweatshirt and a hat, pointing toward a woman in fishnet, thigh-high stockings, a thong, and a top barely larger than a butterfly. It was some rack. Watching this sad sack inspired several thoughts, including, all things considered, sweatpants really don't have much going for them. He got in line as he high-fived his buddy, another Raiders-clad and sweat-panted young fellow. "Hey, hottie," said another porn star wearing ethereal pink wings on her back. She looked like some sort of sex pixie, and wrapping her arms around a chubby guy in a flannel shirt. On the screen above her, she shouted, "Yes, yes, oh yeah, baby, right there, yeah!" She pulled the flannel guy closer, and they posed for a camera and grinned. A pair of hand-in-hand female porn stars, their faces glinting with glitter, passed me as I stood and watched, taking notes. "I need a drink," said one of them lowly. "Like three," said her friend. "Party!" screamed an enormous man with a shaved head and a fine suit and eyes red-rimmed already. "From what? Booze? Drugs? Both? Woo-hoo!" He pointed at a woman in a thong and steep pumps who was bent over at her waist and grabbing her ankles for the sake of a photograph. "I'm getting me some of that." Despite the volume of unfortunate, but by no means surprising, frat boy high fives and what might be best described as hollers, I must admit there was something positively erotic for me, at least for a bit, about being in the company of women who would do just about anything sexual. I brushed against them in the crammed halls as I wandered with Annie, scribbling in my notebook, and I encountered them at their booths and immediately imagined them naked. It didn't take much imagination. At the same time, it crossed my mind that these women had done everything, things unimaginable with male porn stars, men whose resumes hinge on the length and breadth of their manhood. Would anything less than a giraffe's neck satisfy these nymphs? And if sex equals work in their world, doesn't that equation have great potential to make sex drudgery? It was dizzying, amazing. Annie and I gawked at the latex-sheathed fetish queens and their gay counterparts, the guys Swiss-cheesed with studs and rings and swaddled in black leather. We could not believe the breasts. We could not believe the blow-up dolls or the pocket vaginas, rubbery, flesh-colored sleeves that men buy and have sex with. We could not believe the dildos like butternut squash and anacondas and Pringles cans. "Oh, my God," said Annie when we arrived at our first dildo display. "Is that supposed to be a penis?" Maybe in some alien universe, I offered sheepishly. Annie started talking up the sex toy vendors, which made me slightly uncomfortable. I shot around nervous glances as she chatted as if we were in a public park, and Annie, for some reason, had decided to cop a few rocks of crack from a wandering dealer. Annie and I lost ourselves in the show, this cavalcade of decadence. We paced down the aisles, our eyes wide, past porn stars licking penis lollipops and posing for pictures, past Jenna Jameson high on a display, signing autographs. Worshipful men lined up to get a picture of themselves with the high priestess of porn. The experience drove us both into something like a trance, a condition we both found quite agreeable. But we were having dinner with an old friend of mine that evening, and we had to complete sex number six, before the night's end. So we returned to our room, parted the heavy curtains, and let in the lights of the strip. We showered and then flopped onto the big bed. "What do you say? Straight to the chase?" said Annie. "Well, that's two quickies in a row," I said warily. "We've got, what, 97 lovemaking sessions to go," said Annie as we embraced in the bed, "and most of them will be in our bedroom in Denver. But we're in Vegas now. We're going to out to dinner. We've got to move." I dragged my palm across her hip and kissed her. "You're talking sense," I said. I stroked her for a few minutes before she invited me inside. And then for the first time in a while, probably since a summer beach vacation more than a year earlier, we did it at an elevation lower than a mile in the sky. Vegas sits at about 2,100 feet. "Sex is good closer to sea level," said Annie after we'd finished, both of us lost in a post-sex tie, propped up in bed. Let's see, okay. Here we are, just somewhere in the middle of the sexpedition. Annie wore a slip that evening. The New York Times that week had proclaimed slips as the sexy new thing. Prior to our experiment, she likely never would have noticed the Times article, much less squeezed into a slip based on the article's breathless enthusiasms. "The Times is right," I said. "The slip is very sexy. Who knew?" After another 20-minute round of weightlifting, it was a new one for me, for the sake of this sexpedition. Anyway, after another 20-minute round of weightlifting and a shower, I put on my silk robe and began pawing through the bag full of sex show swag, which we kept hidden on a high shelf in our closet. "Porno?" Annie said, sounding less than bubbly. We'd gotten lots of free porno at this show. "One of those moist towelettes," I said, "supposed to enhance erections. I want to experiment and keep things interesting." "Interesting?" said Annie, her voice tinged with concern and worry. "You bored?" "No," I said, "just interested in trying some of the stuff we scored at the show. For the sake of the marathon, at least, see if it does anything." Buried beneath DVDs, magazines, vials of lube, condoms, and much more, I finally found the foil packet containing a product called Keep Dick Hard. I read the list of ingredients. "Caffeine," I said, "and pepper." I paused, rereading. "I don't know about this," I said. "Pepper? Will it move from your penis to my vagina?" said Annie, sounding appalled. We both stared at the packet. "What the hell," said Annie. "What's the worst that could happen?" "Well, besides otherworldly pain," I said, and ripping open the packet, withdrawing the white, wet towelette, and with no ceremony, swabbing. We sat cross-legged on the bed, both of us admiring my penis. I don't believe we had ever gathered around my penis before in the manner of mycologists on a field trip discovering a rare and prized variety of chanterelle. "It tingles," I said, and then my slightly tumescent penis began to swell and then to harden. "It's like watching sea monkeys grow," said Annie. "Just add water." She lay back. "Here goes," she said. "I'm either about to have fun or get my reproductive organs lathered in pepper." I entered the castle tentatively, cautiously, like a lost knight, uncertain about the political affiliations of the royalty enthroned within. "How's that?" I asked as my sword reached the end of the scabbard. "Sorry. So far, so good," reported Annie. No evidence of pepper yet." We went at it gingerly and steady for a good 10 minutes with no sign of discomfort. "I think we're good to go," said Annie. "Hold on." She turned perpendicular to the bed, hanging her head over the side of the mattress. I kissed her highly exposed neck. Eventually, we flopped onto our backs and panted. "Love the position," said Annie. "I got good leverage," I said. "And I love nibbling your neck." Something poked my spine. I reached behind and retrieved a Polly Pocket doll, one of the little dolls that our daughters spend hours dressing up in tiny outfits. "She looks like a porn star," I said. "Almost no clothes, tiny feet, big boobs, and even bigger hair." "Speaking of porn stars," I said, flinging the plastic doll from the bed and gazing at my still raging erection, "I wonder if they use these towelettes." "Well, it seems to be working," said Annie, pointing and then climbing between the sheets and pulling the comforter to her chin. "It's tingly, but also numb," I said. "It seems somewhat beyond my control." I followed Annie between the sheets, reaching down every minute to inspect the erection's ferocity. After about 10 minutes, it started to flag. In another minute, it was gone. "Whew," I said, looking over at Annie, who I assume was at least half awake, but she was out cold. Keep Dick Hard, I considered, just before drifting off. It was interesting. Was the sex any better than with an unpeppered, decaffeinated penis? I'm not sure the intercourse itself felt any better, although the introduction of the head off the bed position wasn't a pleasant surprise. In short, the sex was somewhat jazzier, but I wasn't sure that keep dick hard had anything to do with it. Okay, let's see here. Okay. Performing for 100 days during Denver's Greenland-esque winter did offer some advantages. Dusk's early arrival made it easier to put the girls to bed. The deep freeze nudged us into our own bed and begged us to warm each other, which we've been doing for nearly 3 weeks. That night, after a hot yoga session transformed me from exhausted and irritable to enlivened and blissed out, I showered, lit candles and incense, and moved straight into foreplay. Had this not been day 17, I doubt we'd ever have had the bright idea to have sex on an exercise ball. But we knew we had more than 80 sessions to go, and we were feeling more adventurous sexually than ever before. "How about here?" I said, pushing the ball to the center of the floor. "I'm game," said Annie, sitting on the ball and spreading her legs. With my angled erection leading the way, I came to her, working to fit myself inside. "Hold on," said Annie as I pressed into her. "Whoa!" The ball rolled to the side. We both listed, our hands first waving around for balance, then reaching down to soften the blow. We both were sure it was coming. We hung there for a few moments without falling to the floor before managing to right the exercise ball. "Well, that was exciting," I said. "Maybe there's a better way," said Annie. "We could try pushing it to the edge side of the bed," I offered. Voila! The ball bounced her hips up and down, sliding me in and out of her warm utopia with great force and rhythm. It was wild. We pushed the ball back to its resting place, a corner in the bedroom, and flopped on the comforter, still panting from the intense burst of exertion. "We'll have to do that again," said Annie. We lay together silently for a while. "What do you think of cock rings?" said Annie. "Actually, I don't think of them," I said, startled. "In addition, I don't like thinking about, or God forbid, actually pronouncing those two words together like that." "Well, the marathon led me to the internet this afternoon, where I spent 30 minutes looking for cock rings for you," she said. "I almost bought one, but I didn't know if you'd really like it." "Well, you know the swag bag has one, right?" "Oh, that's right," she said. "Glad I didn't get you a new one. Are you going to try it?" I shrugged. I did not like talking about this device. I did not like thinking about this device. And when Annie said the words, "cock ring," they appeared in my mind's eye as if scrawled in fire. Okay, here's a real pathetic, embarrassing one of many embarrassing Pratt chapters. But that night, for the first time since moving to Colorado, we showered together, which stands as a truly pathetic admission. Here we had a gleaming bathroom described enthusiastically by the real estate folks all around us in the sprouting subdivision as a five-piece, meaning a toilet, two sinks, a separate bathtub, and a shower. The shower stall occupied as much space as a decent walk-in closet and even had a bench. We never had a shower seat before, which of course could aid at any stab at shower sex. And nevertheless, I had showered alone and Annie had showered alone until tonight. We lathered, we slid our hands across our slick bodies, and we tiptoed toward the sex zone. "Mmm," said Annie, kissing me lightly. "This is nice. We haven't had shower sex for a long time." "And this is a good shower," I answered. "The best out of 12. It's even got the bench." I ran my hands across her back. I reached down and cupped her cheeks, lightly squeezing fistfuls of flesh as she kissed my neck and fondled my quickening stiffness. She stood in the stream of hot water and smiled as she crooked her neck and invited the water to massage her face, to stream down her long hair, cascading toward the ground. And then I abruptly untangled myself and stood washboard straight, startling Annie. She nearly slipped. "What the hell?" she said. "What are you doing?" "I'm sorry, honey, but it's, you know, it's my nose thing." "Oh, my God. You're going to do that thing you do in the shower now?" "Yeah," I said. "Suddenly, I really have to." The shower door opened. She was gone. Colorado's exceedingly arid climate had transformed the inside of my nose from a happy terrarium into Death Valley. Rattlesnakes and scorpions would kill to nest in my nostrils. Every morning, I spend about 10 minutes standing in steam, inhaling moisture into my desiccated, brittle nasal passages, and then exhaling the desert life that had accumulated during the previous day and evening. Sometimes the cache of crusts grew suddenly painful, and excavating it became urgent. "Sexy," said Annie, when I stepped out of the shower. "No wonder we haven't showered together." "Sorry," I murmured, scurrying to the bed and slipping under the covers, the room dancing with candlelight and incense smoke. This unfortunate episode points out a possible problem in our relationship, a complication centered squarely on my wee head. Had the shower encounter happened early in our relationship, it never would have occurred to me. It would have been beyond the realm of possibility to purge my nose with Annie so naked and so hot beside me. You must be thinking, you idiot, what were you thinking? I had grown too comfortable with our relationship. I took Annie's love and adoration for granted. I did not stop to consider the ramification of my broadcasting of nasal shrapnel. Were the tables turned, had Andy pulled such nonsense, I would have reacted with disgust, which is how Andy responded. How she managed to actually sleep with me after that, I do not know. I did at least note her reaction, her panicked retreat from the shower stall, and this stuck with me. Don't do that again, I said to myself. Jackass! After both of us warmed up in our cocoons, I emerged and turned on our favorite radio station, an almost fetishized spot on the dial for many music fans, a station based in New York with a highly eclectic range of DJs and programs. And then we sat across from each other, kissing and hugging and petting, both of us nude. Why don't you go on your stomach, I said, by way of peace offering. And he looked at me warily. That's a good start, she said. I poured grapeseed oil into my hand and commenced massaging. I explored her back with my palms, pressing with more weight than seemed wise, but she responded with enthusiasm, so I continued. She eventually sat up, poured a dollop of lube into her palm, and gestured me onto my back. Nice, I said, smiling wildly, despite the whole shower thing. Yeah, very despite, she said. She kept going and going and going, and I lay back and lost myself in pure pleasure, despite the music, which had changed from something musical to the sound of a stick striking the side of a table. Notwithstanding the racket, I could have orgasmed, but decided that might not count as sex. So far, we'd had intercourse every night. I wasn't about to change the rules unilaterally at the start of week 3. Great ride, said Annie. Surprising, too, after the shower disaster. I think the massage helped, despite your claim that massages and sex are, in general, not intimately linked. In tonight's case, it's possible, said Annie. We stayed up for a bit reading. As usual, Annie fell asleep with a book in her lap. I placed the book on the floor, and Annie woke up. Did I fall asleep? She asked, rubbing her eyes. Of course, honey, I said. I turned out the light. Do I have more time? Good. Let's see. What the hell? It's another embarrassing one, but... All along, in the car, walking to TJ Maxx, later doing research in the public library for a project about pornography that I was just beginning for the Post, I'd been doing an exercise that I hesitated to disclose for fear of ridicule, not only from male friends, but also from the male community at large. Let me stipulate here that this exercise, like the weightlifting, the musk lotion, the pocketless pajamas, the occasional morning runs, the Thurston Howell the Third robe, the huge glasses of orange juice I drank every morning, the doc had said I needed citrus for the sake of Annie's balance. And my increased delivery of massages to Annie, all of this was born out of a desire to please my wife, this woman who had the idea of having sex with me for 100 consecutive days. And so, for Annie, I had been doing Kegels, exercises that strengthen various muscles around the sexual organs. Annie had been performing them for years. I never considered doing Kegels. They seemed like something for the women's only world, like tampons or eyeliner. Until I read a few books that said men should do Kegels because they can increase erection strength and permit men to hold their ejaculations for longer and longer periods of time. The achievement of both of these, especially in light of the marathon, was something to seek out and celebrate. So I did Kegel exercises, and of course, did not tell anybody but Annie, who responded, I love Kegels, good for you! Which I hasten to add was not a response that exactly buttressed my sense of manhood. At some point during this afternoon of Kegels, I considered how central my penis had become to my life during the past 33 days. I found myself thinking about my penis all day long. How are you doing now, pal? You're the star, friend. Just stay positive. You can do it. This night, I thought, should be a good test of the libido and its supporting cast of one, the penis. We were joining Tucker Shaw, the Post's food critic, a guy who had spent an entire year photographing everything he ate and then publishing a book about it for dinner at a nouveau Cuban restaurant. So tonight would be Annie's and my second date of the sexathon that demanded sex after dinner and drinks. If the hydraulics were beginning to gasp without booze or big meals and after sitting on the bed with Annie for long periods of time, gearing up for an erotic interlude, How would they respond to a rushed late-night commitment, challenged by cocktails and saddled with food? Annie startled me when she appeared at the bottom of the steps of our house, sheathed in patterned stockings, a revealing black top accentuating her cleavage, her hair lavish, her lips succulent. The girls fluttered around their mother, telling her that she smelled nice, that she looked pretty, that they liked her hair, and so on. They bestowed praise, too, on my sport coat. Minutes later, the babysitter rang the doorbell, and we were off, yakking while I drove, and then Annie ran her arm through mine as we raced along cold downtown sidewalks to the restaurant. Nothing could have made me prouder. "Hey, everyone, she's mine." The food was wan, but the mojitos stunned. Annie was giggly and sly and devastatingly sexy, and she hatched an immediate friendship with Tucker, all of which drew me to her with even more urgency. I even found it cute when she spilled my mojito across the table. I failed to heed my inner counsel, who was wagging his finger and going on about substantial meals are not conducive to the consummation of a certain physical act, blah, blah, blah. I ordered a big plate of protein, a piece of fish, nesting in a pile of carbohydrates. I consumed dessert. I probably would have ordered the same thing had Tucker not been with us. My hunger had hijacked my scruples, but the fact that we were with Tucker sealed the deal. Tucker, I should say, the Denver Post, had the meal covered. This was an opportunity to fully leverage the very essence of our free is best motto. I was unwilling to pass up a single calorie. The babysitter, one of our yoga instructors, drove herself home. Annie and I showered and slipped into bed about 11:30, about an hour after we normally fell asleep. Food weighed down my stomach. Two mojitos dulled my libido. We moved straight to sex. Nothing oral, no advanced petting or foreplay, just a swab of lube. Bada bing. 10 minutes later, bada boom. Marathon sex, said Annie groggy, just before falling into dreamland. Seems, sometimes you could do it just to do it. And she had a point. Hold on. The next night, I responded favorably to the vision of Annie's hot lingerie, to her freshly pedicured toenails, red toenails, to her marble smooth thighs. As the visual stimuli marched through my brain, an audible one, too, arrived. I heard a slight buzzing sound, just as the show Annie and I were watching on DVD came to a close. What's that noise? I asked. Annie whipped out, this is the name of the sex toy we bought in Vegas, two fingers and a thumb from beneath her robe and grinned. I'm ready. With both of us fully stimulated, we conspired to consummate love session number 35. This is becoming wild, I thought, after we'd finished. I was planning to save the sack of Viagra my doctor tossed at me until I really needed it. But now I just wanted to up the ante. Let's see. Okay, a short thing here on Viagra. You're acting like a freak, reported Annie. At exactly 7:11 p.m. the following night, I finally pressed a little blue pill from its cardboard container and swallowed it. By the time the girls were in bed, about an hour later, a parched, pinched sensation fluttered into my throat. In my eyes, an attention darted like hummingbirds on a delphinium farm. It felt as if I just finished one too many espressos. In the shower, his lordship experienced volts of lightning bolt energy and soon emerged as a mysterious new appendage that worked independently of my brain. When I re-entered the bedroom, Annie was wearing sexy French lingerie, and when she bent over to get something, my new buddy, autonomous appendage, moved straight toward her. The amour commenced. I don't recall ever feeling so driven towards sex. It was a possession more than a desire. 20 minutes of blur later, it was over, and I collapsed, a spent internal combustion engine, a satisfied dog. Annie pointed toward autonomous. What do you think? Is he going to calm down? I looked down. Awfully taut, isn't it? I said. Yeah, and it isn't even beginning to droop. I propped myself up on my elbows and waited for 1 minute, 3, 6, no change. Would autonomous finally submit to my will and go to sleep? Would this possession require some sort of formal exorcism? Chance, holy water, a shaman, before drifting away. After 10 minutes, I began to worry. You will recall the emergency room, Mrs. Alleen, something earlier. The emergency room, the kid with the busted arm, the man beside the ribbons, all that is curdled in America. At about the 15-minute mark, though, autonomous tripped, then fell, and then plummeted into sleep, and I followed him. Let's see. Here's another short one. After we're in the Brown Palace here. This is day 50. After one of the slowest, most leisurely mornings I'd had in years, Annie and I elected to shoot for the morning delight. Unlike every couple in cinema and television who wake up and then soon have sex, we first brushed our teeth. Then we nearly jumped back onto the big bed, clutching each other and kissing and laughing. As the playfulness grew a bit more serious, I began to feel almost religious about this halfway point session. Something had clicked inside me, and sex had started to change from this occasional, monumental, pressure-filled evening event into something more natural and easy and relaxed. At some point in the last 49 days, my attentiveness to Annie and her needs had quietly shifted from a pleasurable task that demanded completion before actual sex, intercourse, could take place, to an ecstatic end in itself. I consciously understood now that this change had taken place, although I couldn't pinpoint a day or a sexual encounter that was the tipping point. We were having intercourse every night for the sake of the marathon, and I think 50 days into it, the intercourse helped bring me to this new appreciation. But at this crossroads, I understood sex was much more than the fulfillment of a technical definition. Once the gold staff is inserted in the satin cleft, the sexual act is complete. Sex, at least for me, was a full immersion in pleasure, not trading gratifications. I bring Annie to orgasm, and then she brings me to orgasm, but absorption in both Annie and myself, in our flesh. I found pleasuring Annie an end in itself, a pursuit that galvanized every grain of libido I possessed. Foreplay, in other words, wasn't separate from sex. In fact, they were the same thing. All right. Okay, this is the very end here. Okay, I'll just do the epilogue here. Shortly after moving into the new house, we had moved to Boulder since all this happened. We had lived in Denver at the time. Shortly after moving into our new house, we bought a hammock that really was more like a seat than a stretcher and hung it from a big tree in our backyard. The next morning, we sprang for another hammock and dangled it from the same limb. The girls had fought so fiercely and incessantly about the hammock that we quickly decided we needed one for each of them. During summer evenings, after the elves were in bed, Annie and I always brought beers to the garden-thick yard, and during what we called hammock time, we would swing and talk. By now, the marathon had been over for more than a year, but we still occasionally asked each other what the whole thing had been about, usually while swaying in our hammocks. Would we ever try it again? Had the marathon really introduced long-term changes into our relationship? Had it engendered anything entirely novel and concrete? The knitting, I said one warm night. I think we can find a direct link between the marathon and the knitting. That makes sense, said Annie. The year after the marathon, Annie turned 40. Needless to say, a biggie. I invested a lot of time and thought in her exit from her 30s, but none of the gifts that crossed my mind seemed worthy. Jewelry, a long weekend somewhere. It finally occurred to me that Annie would treasure something handmade, because that's just Annie, very Annie. I toyed with taking pottery classes on the sly and throwing a few pots for her. Or if I learned some basic woodworking skills, I reasoned maybe I could make a table for our new house. And then it hit me. Annie loved to knit. I'd never betrayed even a tuft of interest in understanding how to make clothing out of sticks and string. If I secretly figured out how to knit and made her something, she would treasure it forever and cherish her 40th birthday. So I took knitting lessons from the owner of a yarn shop. I spent a few nights a week using fancy yarn to knit a long, broad scarf, sitting with groups of women who gravitated to the store in the evenings to sip tea, and sometimes booze, and to, as they called it, stitch and bitch. Sometimes I felt like Norm on Cheers when I stepped into the store. The women in unison would yell, "Doug!" The owner would then command me to tell people I hadn't yet met what she called my... No. The owner would then command me to tell people I hadn't yet met what she called my awe story. I then report what I was doing there, and they would, without exception, say, "Aw." Annie knew I was doing something in the evenings that related to her birthday, but she assumed it was something more, shall we say, masculine. The scarf achieved its objective, and he barely took it off for days. In addition, the girls and I spent evenings in the basement for weeks making things for Annie, wooden boxes and canvases that we painted, clay that we shaped into cups and bowls, a pair of stepping stones for the garden, and so on. Annie cried as he presented the gifts, and she repeatedly said, almost in the manner of a chant, "This is my best birthday ever." Once sex swooped back into our life after the brief hiatus, Annie and I did it with more passion, virtuosity, and volume than we had displayed before the marathon. What had been 3 times a month, if we were lucky, progressed to about 6 times a month, 2 weeks a month, which is one fling between the sheets, and 2 weeks with a pair of romps. The improvements in our sex life percolated into other aspects of our life together. We touched more. Our conversations seemed easier and more lit with honesty. I felt I understood Annie's interior world better than ever, and she felt the same about me. Just 100 days of daily sex had accomplished something important in our relationship.
that had escaped us during the previous 14 years of making love, moving around the country, and raising children. For the first time in our marriage, I think we really began to fit together. Not only on dates, not only during great vacations or during incandescent but brief moments that sometimes occurred during lovemaking, but also while cooking in the middle of a Saturday spent pursuing species within the genus child activity, and while I toiled at the office in Denver and Annie worked home in Boulder, and every time we made love. Annie and I never had drifted too far from each other, but to the extent that our lives had veered in separate directions and our union had wavered, the marathon succeeded, as Annie put it, early in the adventure, in screwing us back together again. A year later, the bond still seemed fresh and strong, yet from time to time, we still voiced regret about the marathon's ending. We longed for the intensity we'd experienced during those 100 days. It was as if we were decent weekend sailors who one summer decided to let the wind carry us from Florida to Trinidad, to Dakar, to the Cape Verde Islands, to Lisbon. A year later, our sailing abilities were of a different order and our trips much more ambitious, but still, we dreamed of returning to that dreamy, stirring summer on the sea. We missed the atmospheric ferment of it all. Here's the beauty part. Where revisiting a sailing trip would have required large periods of time away from work and home and substantial financial investments, repeating the sex adventure demanded only that Annie and I have sex. So, at some point, we stopped invoking the marathon because we understood that having sex for 100 consecutive days, though sometimes quite a gas, was actually entirely quite unnecessary. Just making love for a month would do wonders, we thought, or for 2 weeks, or even 10 days or 1 week. Just do it. That's it. Thank you. Thanks. Is that good? Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fota, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Chuck Klosterman, Jules Pfeiffer, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on September 17th, 2008.